I want to start today with a scenario. It's a Tuesday night. You've just bought a new set of stainless steel forks for your kosher kitchen. You go to the mikveh to dip them, to immerse them, because, that's what you do with new vessels.
Yeah.
Or maybe change the scene. A woman is going for her monthly immersion. It's quiet, it's private. You're standing at the edge of the water. Do you say a blessing? And if you do, when do you say it?
It sounds like the most basic question in Jewish life, doesn't it?
Right.
Like asking if you say a blessing on bread or wine. It feels like something that should have been settled 2,000 years ago.
Exactly. It feels like Jewish Living 101.
Mm.
But we have a source text today that takes this simple act, dunking in water, and turns it into, a high-stakes legal drama. We're looking at a text called Sephardi Tahor by Chen Shaloff. And I have to say, having read through this, this isn't a warm and fuzzy spiritual guide. This is a forensic audit of religious law.
Forensic audit is the perfect way to put it. Shaloff is doing a deep, rigorous analysis of the writings of Maimonides, the Rambam, and his conclusion is jarring. He argues that the way the vast majority of Jews handle immersion today, specifically the blessing and the timing, isn't just a different custom. He argues it's technically illegal.
And he doesn't use soft language. I mean, we aren't talking about better practices or preferred methods. We are seeing words like heresy, rebellion, and prohibition. It's incredibly
It
intense.
is, but to understand why he uses that language, we have to understand the mechanism of Jewish law he's describing.
Oh.
He's building a machine here.
Okay.
The mission of this deep dive is to unpack the logic of the blessing. We're going to look at four things: the authority to create a blessing, the danger of adding new ones, the proof that you must bless on immersion, and finally, the part that really upset my understanding of the ritual, the timing. Before or after the dip?
Stick a pin in that before or after thing, because that blew my mind. But let's start with the authority, because I think most of us assume blessings are just a tradition. Like, they evolved over time. People felt grateful, so they wrote a prayer. King David wrote some. Maybe a rabbi in the Middle Ages wrote some.
And that is exactly the assumption the source wants to demolish. Shaloff points out that with one exception, grace after meals, which is biblical, every blessing we say was drafted by a specific legislative body, Ezra the scribe, and his court, the Sanhedrin.
So this goes back to the beginning of the Second Temple era. We were talking about the founding fathers of the liturgy.
Right. And the source uses this incredibly powerful metaphor found in the Talmud. They call the text of a blessing a matbeah. In Hebrew, that literally means a coin.
I've heard the phrase coined a term, but this implies something much more rigid.
Think about currency. The sovereign power, the government, mints the coin. It has a specific weight, a specific image, a specific value. If you or I go into the basement and start striking our own coins because we think the design could be prettier, or maybe we want to add a decimal point, what is that?
That's counterfeiting. It's a federal crime. You go to jail for that.
Precisely. The source argues that once the sages stamped the formula of a blessing, it became fixed currency. Maimonides rules that after the Talmud was sealed, roughly 1500 years ago, the mint was closed. The authority to strike new coins or blessings ceased to exist.
So the liturgy is effectively frozen in time.
In a way, yes.
So if I'm feeling spiritually moved by a sunset and I compose a new blessing using God's name and kingship, I'm not being pious. I'm not just being extra spiritual.
According to this legal framework, no, you're being a forger. Maimonides says changing the wording is unworthy, but inventing a new blessing that relies on the formula of the sages, that enters the territory of violating biblical law.
This brings us to the do not add prohibition, Deuteronomy 12.32. Everything I command you, you shall be careful to do it. You shall not add to it or subtract from it. I've always read that as don't say there are 614 commandments. But the source takes it much further.
Much further. The source argues that if you institute a religious practice, like a new ritual or a new blessing that the Sanhedrin didn't authorize, you are effectively claiming to have a new prophecy. You're saying God wants this, when God's authorized representatives never said that.
It's basically identity theft of the divine will.
That's a great way to put it. And the penalty is severe. The source defines someone who adds unauthorized practices as a zakin mamre, a rebellious elder. In the times of the temple, that was a capital offense. It's considered a direct challenge to the authority of the Torah itself.
Now we have to address the elephant in the room. because when the source talks about adding to the Torah, he isn't just talking about modern innovations. He takes aim at some very sacred cows in Jewish tradition. I was reading the section where he talks about Kabbalah and the Zohar.
Yes, we have to report this carefully because it is highly controversial. Shalov's text argues that the mystical traditions, specifically the Zohar and Kabbalah, are prime examples of this violation.
I read that section three times to make sure I wasn't hallucinating. He called the Zohar false prophecy.
He actually compares the additions in the Zohar to Christianity, suggesting that both introduce new theological concepts and rituals that were foreign to the Torah of Moses and the Talmud. He calls them pro-Christian in their structure of adding to the law.
That is a scorching hot take. I mean, for most Orthodox Jews, the Zohar is holy. It's the soul of the Torah.
It is, but you have to follow his logic to understand the critique. He believes in a closed-loop legal system. Moses to the prophets, to the Sanhedrin, to the Talmud, stop. Anything that comes after and claims to reveal new secrets or new rituals is, by definition, a violation of do not add. He sees it as debris that has covered up the original structure of the law.
So his goal is to strip the paint off the wall and get back to the original brick. He's saying, I don't care about the last 500 years of custom. I care about the original code.
Exactly. He wants the coin of Ezra the scribe, not the modifications of 16th century mystics.
Okay, so we've established a very strict environment. No new blessings. No improvisation. But that creates a logical problem for our topic. If we can't invent blessings, why do we think we need to say one for dunking a fork in water? Did Ezra the scribe specifically care about my stainless steel spatula?
This is where the source is really brilliant. It builds a syllogism, a logical proof, to show that the blessing for immersion isn't an invention, it's a requirement of the original system.
Walk us through the steps.
Yeah.
Because if the Sanhedrin didn't explicitly say bless on the spatula, how do we get there?
Step one, premise A, Maimonides, states clearly that the sages instituted blessings for all mitzvah, for all commandments. Just like you bless before eating an apple to acknowledge the creator, you bless before doing a mitzvah to acknowledge the commander. It's a universal rule.
Okay, that's standard. If it's a mitzvah, it gets a blessing.
Step two, premise B, is immersion a mitzvah?
I assume yes.
It's not a guess, it's a definition. Maimonides defines immersion, whether for a woman's purity or for vessels, as a positive commandment. For vessels, the source analyzes the verses in Numbers about the spoils of war from Midian. Scripture says the metal implements must pass through fire and water.
So it's a biblical requirement.
Whether it's biblical or rabbinic is debated in the Talmud, but Maimonides classifies the act itself as a mitzvah. So if A equals all mitzvot need blessings, and B equals immersion is a mitzvah,
then C is unavoidable. You must recite a blessing.
Correct. It's not optional. If you dip the fork without the blessing, you have performed the physical action, the fork is kosher, but you have failed the requirement of listening to the sages. You've essentially robbed the commander of his acknowledgement.
So the blessing isn't just decoration, it's part of the obedience.
Exactly. Now, this brings us to the part that actually affects what people do in the privacy of the mikveh, the timing. And this is where the friction between law and custom explodes.
The common custom, and I've checked this with people, is that a woman enters the water, dips once, comes up, covers her hair or crosses her arms, says the blessing, and then dips again.
Right. That is the standard procedure in almost every community today.
And the logic I've always heard is that she isn't pure until the first dip, so she can't say a blessing yet. Or maybe she's naked, so she has to cover up first. It feels very logical.
It feels logical to us. But our source, Sephardi Tahor, looks at Maimonides and says, this is wrong. And not just different style wrong, but violating the rule wrong.
What is the rule?
The rule for all commandments is a phrase in the Talmud, over las yatan. That means prior to their performance.
Like the apple, you bless, then bite.
Exactly. You don't bite, chew, swallow, and then say, thank you, God. That would be absurd. You bless the shofar, then blow. You bless the tefillin, then bind. So why, the source asks, would immersion be different?
Well, isn't there ever an exception? Surely the people doing the dip then bless custom have a source?
They do, relying on later authorities. But Maimonides, who this source treats as the ultimate authority, lists only one exception. And the source argues that this exception is the key that unlocks the whole puzzle. Maimonides explicitly discusses the convert, the juror.
Okay, let's look at the convert. What happens there?
Imagine a non-Jew converting to Judaism. The final step is the mikveh. Maimonides rules that the convert goes into the water, dips, comes up, and then blesses.
Why?
Think about the text of the blessing. Blessed are you who sanctified us with his commandments and commanded us. Before that dip, the convert is not Jewish. They are not sanctified. They are not commanded. They cannot truthfully say those words.
They would be lying if they said it before.
Exactly. They have to dip to enter the covenant before they can bless. It's a physical impossibility to bless first.
That makes perfect logic.
But here is the gotcha moment in the source. Maimonides writes, there is no mitzvah where one blesses after the action except for the immersion of the convert alone.
Alone. That's a very specific word.
He isolates the convert, which implies that for everyone else, including the woman immersing for Nida, the standard rule applies. She is already Jewish. She is already sanctified. She has no barrier to saying the blessing.
So the source is arguing that people took the exception for the convert and mistakenly applied it to the Jewish woman.
That is exactly the argument. Or they invented reasons about holding cure status that Maimonides never accepted. The source is adamant. You stand on the bank or you stand in the water but haven't dipped yet. You say the blessing and then you immerse. Over lasiaton. Prior to the action.
If you do it the other way. If you follow the common custom.
According to this strict reading, you've missed the boat. You blessed on something you already finished. It's a waste of blessing, a brasha levatala, which is a severe prohibition in itself because you used God's name in vain.
And is heavy. You think you're being modest, but really you're taking God's name in vain.
That's the danger the source is highlighting. Good intentions don't fix bad law.
It's amazing how high the stakes are for something that seems like a minor procedural detail. But we aren't done with the details. We have to talk about grammar. Because usually grammar is boring, but here, grammar is theology.
Yes. The syntax determines the validity of the coin.
The source spends a significant amount of time debating two tiny Hebrew prefixes, lamed el and al, to do versus on the doing.
This is where the forensic analysis gets really granular. Maimonides has a system for which prefix gets used, and if you swap them, you break the system.
I'll be honest, I just memorize the blessings.
Okay.
I say ladlik ner to light the candle or al nedalat yadayim on the washing of hands. I never noticed there was a pattern.
There is a very specific system in Maimonides. The source breaks it down. The prefix L, too, is used for what he calls personal obligations or absolute duties.
Give me an example.
Sitting in a sukkah, putting on tefillin, hearing the shofar. These are things you must do. The focus is on the future action. I am to do this thing. It's a duty falling on my shoulders.
Okay. And L.
L, the object's word, is used for two categories. First, things done for others. But relevant to us, it's used for enabling actions or things that are optional entry points.
Enabling actions, that sounds like technical jargon.
Think about ritual slaughter, shechita. You aren't commanded to eat meat. You can be a vegan. But if you want to eat kosher beef, you must slaughter it. The slaughter enables the eating. It's a prerequisite.
So you don't wake up in the morning saying, I must kill a cow today. But if you want a burger, the slaughter is the gateway.
Exactly. And washing hands, same thing. You don't have to eat bread. But if you do, you must wash. The washing enables the meal. So we say al hashechita on the slaughter and al nedalat yadayim on the washing.
I see the pattern. It's conditional. So where does the mikveh fit?
Well, let's test it. Does a woman have to immerse every day?
No. She immerses to permit intimacy with her husband.
Does a person have to buy new forks?
No. But if they do, they have to dip them to use them for eating.
Exactly. Immersion is an enabling action. It removes a barrier impurity to permit something else. Therefore, the source argues it must follow the al pattern.
So saying lit bowl to immerse would be grammatically incorrect.
Not just grammatically incorrect, legally invalid, because you are categorizing the commandment wrong. You are calling an enabler an absolute duty. You are using the wrong coin.
So for the record, if a listener wants to follow this Sephardi Tahor source, what are the exact words?
For a woman, the blessing is Asher Kidshanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu al tevila, on the immersion. For vessels, al tevilat kailim, on the immersion of vessels.
And just to recap the sequence, say that text, then dip.
Correct. Coin valid. Timing valid. Mitzvah fulfilled.
You know, as we go through this, I'm struck by the rigidity of it. It's like computer code. If you have a syntax error, the program doesn't run.
That is exactly how Maimonides views the law. It's a technology for connecting to the divine. If the Sanhedrin wrote the code, you can't just mash the keyboard and hope it works.
But this brings up a huge tension. We have this text by Chen Shaolov fighting for textual authenticity. He wants us to follow the precise instructions of the coin. But on the other side, we have lived religion. We have what people actually do, what their mothers taught them.
That is the central conflict. For many people, the custom is the religion. If you tell a woman, the way your grandmother dipped in the mikveh was heresy, or the blessing you said was a lie, you are attacking her heritage. It feels cold, it feels clinical.
It reminds me of the Protestant Reformation in a way. Sola scriptura. Only the text matters. Strip away the traditions, the mystics, the later editions, and go back to the source code.
That's a very apt comparison. Shalov is arguing that tradition can sometimes be an enemy of truth. He believes that by accumulating all these later customs, dipping before blessing, changing the wording, following the Zohar, we haven't enriched the Torah, we've obscured it.
And he's willing to burn bridges to make that point. Calling the Zohar false prophecy and accusing people of being rebellious elders, that is not how you make friends at the local synagogue.
No, it isn't. But he would argue that the risk of adding to God's law, which we established as a biblical prohibition, is worse than being socially ostracized. He believes he is saving people from a serious sin. He believes he is restoring the pure Sephardi tradition before it was influenced by other movements.
So where does this leave us? We have the source, and we have the reality of what people do.
It leaves the listener with a choice about authority. Who do you follow? Do you follow the minhag, the custom of the community, or do you follow the halacha, the hard logic of the original legal texts as interpreted by Maimonides?
Usually we try to blend them. We say custom is law.
But this source says you can't always blend them. Sometimes they contradict. The logic is binary. Either the coin is real or it's a fake. Either you blessed before the act or you blessed after. You can't do both.
It definitely changes the way I look at a kitchen fork. It's not just silverware. It's a test case for how we relate to 3,000 years of history.
And whether we have the courage to stick to the original instructions, even when everyone else is doing something different.
That's the thought I want to leave everyone with today. We live in a world that is obsessed with innovation. New is always better. We upgrade our phones every year. But we've just spent 20 minutes in a worldview where innovation is the ultimate crime.
It is the ultimate countercultural idea.
So, here is the question. Does strict adherence to the old ways, down to the specific preposition in a sentence, actually preserve the spirit of the law, or does it freeze it in amber? And practically speaking, if you listened to this and realized a custom you've done for 20 years was technically illegal, according to Maimonides, would you change it tomorrow? Or does the fact that your community doesn't make it right in its own way?
That is the question that defines the diversity of Jewish practice today.
Thanks for diving deep with us. We'll catch you on the next one.